and Eric had been missing since Friday night when his father had dropped him off at the club. At first, Ruth thought her son may have driven to Grand Rapids with some friends. The school year was nearing completion and spring had arrived, so the teens were celebratory and restless. Or maybe, Eric's friend suggested, he had rented a hotel room for himself and his girlfriend, something he had done before. But when Saturday morning came and went, and Ruth had heard nothing from Eric, she called the police to report him missing. "That Saturday evening," she says, "was the hardest part of my life, just waiting to hear something." Sunday dragged. Each phone ring, each knock on the door, each car pulling into the complex made Ruth hopeful. Word spread. Some of Eric's friends handed out his photos to local stores. Monday, Ruth returned to work, barely able to focus. "I was climbing the walls," she said. By Wednesday, she was so distraught that she left work in the morning to visit the assistant principal at the high school, Ken Overly. Had he heard anything? Could he question some of Eric's friends? He said he would. On the way home, Ruth stopped at the Coburns, where she joined Jim's wife for a cup of coffee. "I'm still not quite falling apart, thinking maybe he's just out having a good time," she recalls. When Jim came by the house a few minutes later, she knew. "You found Eric, didn't you? He's dead, isn't he?" she asked. Jim nodded. "I'm sorry." Ruth remembers being unusually collected. "I've got to call my mom and sister," she thought to herself. When she arrived home, she placed pictures of Eric all around the living room, on the television, on the coffee table, even on the kitchen counter. She then took out her Bible and opened it to the 23rd Psalm, which she used to read to Eric during trying times, when she didn't have the money to buy him a new pair of shoes, or after he'd flunked driver's education for the third time. With the Bible in one hand and Eric's picture in the other, she rocked back and forth, her eyes tightly shut. She can't recall what images rolled through her mind. The days following the discovery of her son's body are all a haze now, so thick and disorienting that Ruth hesitates to revisit them. She vaguely remembers friends and relatives coming by the apartment, alternately hugging her and asking whether she needed anything. One of her younger brothers, Benny Bowers Jr., a state trooper, drove in from Kalamazoo. Her closest friend, Louise Strand, hurried down from Grand Rapids. Her minister, the Reverend Alfred Johnson, came over, as did friends from work, both black and white. But Ruth felt disembodied, as if she were watching this happen to someone else. It was that someone else who had lost a son. At one point, she felt so hemmed in by the people and the noise that, unnoticed by her visitors, she walked out the front door, picked up a branch lying beneath a pine tree, and began to swing it gently at the ground. As if she were wielding a divining rod searching for water, she carved wandering lines in the dry dirt along the roadside. Walking slowly by the modest wood frame houses, she thought, "Why me? I should never have let him go over there." In the late afternoon sun, a neighbor plowed ground for a garden. Another sat on his front stoop. They certainly had no idea of the weight bearing down on this lone woman, walking aimlessly, her stick stirring up small dust storms. But to Ruth, it just felt like everybody knew. About 100 yards down the street, where the unpaved Lafayette Road meets Madeline Avenue, she paused and picked up a golf ball-sized stone, which she heaved into the woods across the way, aiming for a cluster of rusted-out junk, two metal barrels, a washing machine resting on its side, and a set of box springs. "I wanted to hit something, do something." The rock ricocheted off a tree. Perhaps it was the hollow sound of stone against wood or the emptiness about her, but Ruth began to cry, for the first time. She couldn't stop, and as she turned to go home, now eager for the company of friends and family, she mumbled over and over, "I can't believe it. I can't believe it. I can't believe it." There are many difficult moments for a police officer, but certainly none more distressing than having to deliver news that someone's child has died. That's what Reeves thought he was doing when he drove out to see Ruth. Ruth stood in the doorway, her gaze direct and already weary. It was clear to him from the moment he caught her silhouette in the screen door that she already knew. Her head, her shoulders, her arms, all of her seemed to be battling unsuccessfully the weight she carried. Her body dragged. Her profile, the round face, the full, shapely lips, the high cheekbones, blurred by the screen door, looked familiar, though he couldn't place it. Reeves reached out to take her hand, sandwiching it between his own. "I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry," he repeated clumsily, unsure of what else to say. The two shuffled into the living room and sat side by side on the couch. Reeves held Ruth's hand again and told her what he knew, which at that point wasn't much. Her son, he said, had been found floating in the river by the Coast Guard station. A medical examiner would perform an autopsy later that day. Reeves asked Ruth to describe the clothes Eric had been wearing. He wanted to confirm that they had identified the right boy. Ruth described it all, including the turquoise ring, which had been given to him by his father. She also mentioned a long green winter jacket made by Task Force, a brand popular among black teens. She remembered it well, because she had bought it for him the previous Christmas, and had commented to Eric, before he left for the club, that it was too heavy for such mild weather. Also, Eric, who had high tastes in fashion, had had a friend's mother sew on it a fake fur collar cut from a ragged piece he had bought at a tag sale for a dollar. He wanted it to be different, she said. Reeves made note of it. No coat had been found with the body. Can you tell me when you last saw him? He asked. Friday night, she replied, needing a ball of Kleenex. Eric had been staying with his dad. He called me around 5 o'clock and asked, Mom, if Dad takes me, can I go to the club? I said, sure. Then he asked, would you give me $5? I said sure to that too. Then I called him back and said, you be sure on your way over here you stop and get me a sandwich. And he said, yeah, no problem. So they came through here around 8:45. I'll never forget the time because I'm a diehard Pistons fan and I was watching the game. That's the reason I wanted him to bring me a sandwich, because I didn't want to get up and leave. And he brought me a hamburger and fries from Henry's, and I gave him $5 $1 bills. He asked, how do I look? Do you like my new cologne? And I told him he looked nice. He was dressed real nice. I asked him why he had that big heavy coat on. He told me, it might get chilly, silly. He asked me about his haircut. I said, you look really nice. You have a good time and stay out of trouble. He said, oh, I will. I said, if you don't have a way home and your dad can't pick you up, you call me. I'll be here. Usually if there was a group coming back, they'd all ride together. And then he looked at me and says, remember, I love you, and don't say I never done anything for you. And he teased me about the game. The Bulls are going to kick their butt. Yeah, we used to argue so much about the games. That was it, until his dad called me Saturday and wanted to know if Eric was here. Reeves told Ruth that they had found some money on Eric. How much? She asked. $47, Reeves mistakenly told her. It was actually $49. As Reeves thanked Ruth and again offered his condolences, she handed him the picture of Eric in the white turtleneck. It was the only look he would get of Eric, since he didn't plan to attend the autopsy. He didn't have the stomach for it. Reeves admired the handsome boy in the photo. Ruth melted into the couch. Are you sure? She asked. Are you sure? She breathed deeply and quickly, pulling in air as if she too were drowning. My baby, my baby, my baby. Reeves took her hand. What really bothered me, Reeves said later, was that Ruth was about my age, and seeing what she was going through, I got to thinking about my own daughter. That's a terrible thing, to lose a child. Parents are supposed to go before their children. I went home that night and just hugged McKenna, held her in my arms. Also, we didn't have any answers except that the body was Eric's. She asked all sorts of questions, but all I could do was tell her what I knew. We were waiting for the autopsy report. I really thought there'd be some logical explanation as to what happened. Right away, when you have a young black man floating in the river who was last seen in a predominantly white community, you can visualize anything happening. This might sound strange, Ruth told me, but it was about 4 or 5 days after Eric had died, I was in the basement where we used to live, and it was like he was talking to me, telling me what had happened. I know that sounds weird. A lot of people go, yeah, right. But I don't know if I wanted to believe something so badly now that I think back about it. I wrote down what I thought he told me and put it in an envelope. I got into some trouble and was chased. Things that you didn't know about. I couldn't put it all together because there was just bits and pieces. There was somebody else involved. I couldn't put a face with it. So I ended up tearing it up. And friends. The skull caps pulled low over their heads hid the tears. These friends of Eric's, maybe 15 or 20 teenage boys, gathered on the freshly mowed lawn outside Ruth's home. They bounced from foot to foot, their hands deep in their pockets, their heads deep in their shoulders. A few brandished wooden canes, a fashion statement at the time, waving them around like the long swords of ancient warriors. Ruth could hear the loud, blustery talk through her open living room window. "Eric ain't deserved this. You know them motherfuckers covering up something over there. Ain't that the truth?" They knew what was going on. Man, they probably got something to do with it. They shook and cursed and grumbled some more, and then one of them suggested, "Man, we should go over that bridge and do the same to them." There were shouts of encouragement and talk of the havoc they could wreak. Smash store windows, burn down the club, storm the high school, just plain put the fear of God into those people across the river. Ruth donned her coat and walked into the sea of angry adolescent faces. Her presence brought an immediate calm. The canes came down by their sides. Their high-pitched threats drifted harmlessly into the wind. "They were just waiting for me to say, 'Go get 'em,'" she recalls. "They were ready to go over there and tear down every store, but I didn't want another child killed. I was hurting so bad, I was thinking of every other mother coming back and saying, 'If you hadn't done this, my son would be alive.' I couldn't live with that. I just wanted answers. Answers. I just wanted answers." The boys hung around for much of the afternoon, recalling Eric and damning St. Joseph for its whiteness, its prosperity, its smugness. For these boys, the neighbors across the way were the enemy. Rumors about Eric's death flowed fast. There was the report that he had been found with a noose around his neck, that his hands had been tied behind his back, a rumor that the relatives of a white girl he had dated had done him in, that an older white man seen chasing him down the street had forced him into the river. One story had it that a group of white boys, agitated that Eric had dared to dance with a white girl, beat him and pushed him into the river. There was even a rumor that Eric had committed suicide. At Benton Harbor High School, students learned of Eric's death when it was announced over the PA system during sixth period. As they had done on Ruth's lawn, young boys filled the hallways, surging with bravado, boasting of what they planned to do to St. Joseph. Word spread that one group intended to go over the bridge en masse. One boy strutted through the hallways, pounding on the thin metal lockers with his fists, screaming, "Kill the white people, kill the white people, kill the white people." A white student, there were roughly 100 in the school, eating lunch outside, was cold-cocked by a black teen. Two other white students were jumped after school. The school administration called an assembly for the next day to allow students to let off steam. The students seethed. One boy went to the microphone and announced, "I don't like white people, never liked white people. If they die, they die." When an administrator suggested that they calm down and give Eric a moment of silence, Donnie Allen, a close friend of Eric's, rose from his seat and shouted, "Fuck that. We know who killed him. Let's get them. Let's blow up that club." The students roared their approval. Benny Bowers, Ruth's brother and a Benton Harbor High School graduate, took the stage. Though not in his state trooper's uniform, at 6'4" and a highly sculpted 250 pounds, Benny cut an impressive figure. Moreover, he had been a football and basketball star here, earning Athlete of the Year honors when he graduated in 1976. He knew these halls well. He also knew Eric well. On weekends, Eric would visit Benny and his wife and two children in Kalamazoo, an hour's drive from Benton Harbor. Just hang out, shoot baskets, eat pizza, work on stereos, play with Benny's kids. Benny had been told that some of the kids were talking of marching into St. Joseph. He had seen one boy walking around outside school with a cane in hand, and that worried him. He warned the students at the assembly, "A naive police officer hears gun, and he sees a kid with a cane, and bang, bang, the kid's dead. This is the wrong way to go about it. It's not going to bring Eric back." The students grew quiet as Benny continued. "There'll be an investigation," he promised. "We don't know what happened, but you can't go and take this in your hands. Let the police do their job. They'll find out what happened to Eric. Just let them do their job. They'll get to the bottom of it. I'll make sure of that." He told them that he had viewed the photos, and contrary to what students had heard, there was no noose. He then pleaded that anyone who knew anything about the night Eric disappeared should talk to him. The NAACP had posted a $600 reward for information. The next day, three young black men armed with a pipe and a revolver brutally beat a white couple necking at Tiscornia Park, a pristine Lake Michigan beach just north of the river. Two friends of Eric's cornered a white woman pushing her cart in a grocery store aisle and taunted her in whispered tones with "nigger killer, nigger killer." Five black youths interrupted a girls' softball practice at a local parochial school, threatening to assault the players. Meanwhile, occasional carloads of young white men sped through the streets of Benton Harbor. One car followed Donnie Allen down a residential street until it came abreast of him. A white man leaned out of the window and hollered, "We're going to get you. We're going to get you, motherfuckers." Wheels squealed. Donnie ran. For their part, St. Joseph residents girded for the assault. The club closed down after getting word that carloads of blacks were on their way to shoot up the place. Parents kept their children home from school. And the police, on high alert, patrolled the high school's graduation practice. "This was a time bomb ready to go off," says Reeves. "That river is a real hindrance, a real divide." One night I had a dream that the St. Joseph River was boiling, the bubbles huge and menacing, the steam thick and suffocating. The water, as it washed along the banks, flowed over, forcing onlookers to flee its blistering rush. In the dream, the river spilled just into Benton Harbor. But in the case of Eric McGinnis, the scalding river flooded both shores, and people on both sides fought it the only way they knew how, by rallying their forces, by retreating, by taking refuge behind a high wall of rhetoric. The adversary, each side believed, lurked on the other side of the roiling river. But there were reasons that went well beyond Eric's death. The Shooting, A Tale in Four Parts. The Shooter. The shooting of Norris Maben, a 21-year-old petty thief, occurred a year and a half before Eric's death. Those who wanted to believe that Eric had, indeed, been killed, and killed at the hands of whites, needed to look no further than the killing of this young black man. The fact seemed evident. He was shot by a white policeman, Marv Fiedler. But the truth was more elusive. Fiedler, for all his years on the force, should not have been on the street pursuing a suspected killer, particularly by himself. He was too old, too slow, too nice. If Jim Reeves can be characterized as a small-town cop, then Fiedler was a small-town cop from an earlier era, when a police officer swung a nightstick in one hand and carried chewing gum for the neighborhood kids in the other. At 57, he had spent over half his life as a police officer in Benton Harbor. It was his only law enforcement job. In those years of tooling around in a patrol car, he had put on weight, and he had a soft look about him. His head, reaching out from his hunched shoulders, gave him the appearance of a tortoise in search of food. His oversized glasses, his outsized ears, and a left eyebrow that jumped when he spoke accentuated his physical awkwardness, and his gravelly voice, no doubt the result of his 3 to 4 pack-a-day habit, had a John Wayne tone to it, but without the bravado. There was, as with Reeves, nothing daring about Fiedler. In fact, his fellow officers called him Mother Marv. Fiedler was, by almost all accounts, a genuinely good-hearted person. He occasionally bought deadbolt locks for residents too poor to afford them. He once gave gas money to a stranded motorist. When Fiedler responded to domestic disputes where alcohol was involved, he'd walk around the house collecting the half-filled wine or liquor bottles and then flush the contents down the sink. "Ignorant oil," he'd call it. "Pissed people off," says Tim O'Brien, a fellow officer. Officers joked about Fiedler's inept handling of a gun. No one, they say, wanted to stand next to him during shooting practice because he would mistakenly hit their targets. Says Dale Easton, a former Benton Harbor officer, he was one of the worst shots in the department. He drank so much coffee, smoked so many cigarettes, his hand would shake on the range. I tell you all this for a reason. No one could believe that Marv Fiedler could or would kill a man, even someone he thought was wanted for murder. Benton Harbor residents greeted the new decade with anxiety. The last few months of 1989 had been frightful. Drug gangs had taken hold, giving this small town a big city feel. Over the preceding 12 months, there had been 9 murders, an unusually high number for a city of 12,000. Almost all the victims were black, as were their killers. Fiedler reported for work at 6:45 a.m. on Thursday, January 18, 1990, a bleak winter day, the temperature just above freezing, a blustery Arctic wind blowing down from the north. The new year, though young, looked to be no safer or calmer than the previous months. In the first 2.5 weeks of January, the police received, on average, 2 calls a day of gunfire, mostly from one of the public housing complexes and a neighborhood 8 blocks from the police station. I've walked in that neighborhood many times, and over the years have attempted to count the vacant or fire-damaged homes. But it's a moving number. One 2-story building I've seen with plywood over the windows, and then off, and then on again. and even on the last occasion, there seemed to be some activity in the shuttered house. In this neighborhood, just 3 months earlier, on the evening of September 13th, Pat Gibson, a 17-year-old, was shot to death as she walked toward her home. Photos taken at the crime scene show her lying on her side on the cracked sidewalk next to an overturned shopping cart, her white jogging suit curiously unstained by the puddle of blood around her head. On this particular evening, Gibson, who had been strolling with her two friends along the street, said goodnight and headed in the opposite direction for home. Witnesses say they heard 4, maybe 5 gunshots. Gunshots are so common here that neighbors can distinguish the sounds, and they identified the weapons as a handgun and a shotgun. The police had an immediate suspect, Tracy Hibbler, a 28-year-old Benton Harbor native whom they knew well. Hibbler had been arrested for a series of crimes, from carrying an open beer can in his car to assault with intent to do great bodily harm, for which he served time in prison. According to Earlene Parks, who said she was an eyewitness,